Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is working on the Censored 2017 yearbook and will be back with us next week. My co-host today is Maria Robinson from the Honduras Solidarity Network. In today's show, we're going to ask the question, what's going on that a Goldman Prize winner and internationally known activist, Bertha Cáceres, could be murdered with impunity in Honduras? We'll be talking with Judy Ansel, president of the Cross Border Network for Justice and Solidarity. In addition, we'll talk with Karen Spring, who's the Honduras-based coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network. We hope you stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today is Maria Robinson. She is an activist with the Honduras Solidarity Network and is interested in organizing delegations down to Honduras. Part of her focus is on reaching the 5,000 returning Peace Corps veterans who have served in Honduras. Maria,
happy
welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Happy to have you here. She's a Healdsburg resident, so we're neighbors in Northern California here, and she is going to help facilitate the show today. On the air with us is Judy Ansel. She's the president of the Board of Directors of the Cross Border Network for Justice and Solidarity, a nonprofit organization which developed ties and mutual understanding between people working in Kansas City, where she lives, and workers in Mexico. Their motto is supporting workers across borders. Ansel has traveled 5 times to Honduras in human rights and election monitoring, 2009 up through 16, and speaks about the coup and the surge in violation of worker and human rights since then. Also joining us is Karen Spring, Honduras-based coordinator, Honduras Solidarity Network. She lives in Honduras since 2009, supports grassroots movements impacted by large-scale neoliberal development projects. She has written numerous articles and reports on Honduras and contributed research to the 2000 report, Collateral Damage on the Drug War, the May 11th killings in Awas, and the impact on the U.S. war in drugs on Native Americans in Honduras. Karen, tell us a little bit about your research work on the collateral damage of the drug war.
Hi, Peter. The research, the report specifically outlines the impacts or a specific incident that gives a really good example of some of the impacts of the drug war that is used to justify militarization in Honduras. And the report outlines a specific incident that occurred in May of 2012 where a boat of civilians, indigenous people in eastern Honduras, were traveling down a river at night and they were open fired by a helicopter. That was a State Department funded helicopter and it led to 4 deaths and many people were injured as a result. And the way that the incident was discussed in the press and by U.S. authorities immediately afterwards is that the incident occurred because the people in the boat were transporting cocaine and that they were drug traffickers. And when we started to examine and research the incident and actually talk to the people and the villages that were in the area, we realized that the people were actually just traveling. They were just traveling from town to town and that they were innocent and they had nothing to do with the drug trade. And so the report outlines that specific incident and the impact and more broadly that militarization has had on indigenous populations in Honduras.
Karen, this is Maria. I just wanted to ask you and Judy both, how soon after the incident were you actually on site so that you could personally see this and not just listen to reports from the press, say?
Well, I guess I can take that. This is Judy. We came to Honduras about 10 days after that incident on a tour that was not destined to go to the village of Awas, which is where this incident took place. But Karen, who was the guide for our tour, suggested that we fly in there. Now, this is a really remote area. There's no roads. You have to fly in and then take boats. And so we went in there to take some testimony, talk to the survivors, talk to the witnesses, and we were one of the first groups in there that got the story from the people themselves and saw the horrible wounds that some of the people had and the terrific lack of medical care. It was very disturbing.
How did that incident happen? What was really going on there?
What was really going on was basically a U.S.-commanded botched drug raid, which was aimed at interdicting planes coming in from Colombia that were going to transfer narcotics down to the coast for transport by either speedboat or submarine to the U.S. or Mexico. And they got the wrong boat. And these State Department helicopters opened fire on civilians who were simply traveling to get to their homes. A 14-year-old boy was killed, two pregnant women, and one of the boat's pilots, who was 21 years old.
Do I understand that you've actually visited the victims in the hospital, or at least were able to document, again, with photographs, the wounds they had and so forth?
Yeah, we visited one of the victims in the hospital, actually two of the victims in the hospital, in that trip. One was a woman who actually owned the boat. Her legs were terribly damaged. Both legs had been strafed with bullets, and she was left in the river for hours and hours because the team of police and U.S. FAST team members who were on the helicopters were only concerned about retrieving the drugs that were on another boat that had nothing to do with the boat they shot up. And so they left dead and wounded in the river for hours. And then after they had retrieved the drugs and left, the people were able to go rescue their family members. We visited her, and we visited a young man named Lucio Nelson in the hospital. And he had to wait for 32 days for surgery on his hand because of the totally inadequate medical care that was available and the fact that the family had no money. We met with his mother on a trip this January, and Lucio is now 19 years old, and he is still suffering. He doesn't have full use of his hand. He needs more physical therapy, but there's no money at all. And the U.S. government has completely turned their backs on these people.
So there was no compensation for the families, no apologies? Sorry, we killed you. We didn't mean to. Any of that? Or even an acknowledgement that it happened?
There was acknowledgement that it happened. The Honduran authorities, as well as the U.S. authorities, what they say is that they maintain their position that they were drug traffickers. And there's been discussions about this specific incident with people in the U.S. Congress, and they have a different view of what the official line is regarding the incident. But there's been no public apology by the Honduran or U.S. authorities, no acknowledgement that these were innocent civilians that were traveling on the boat, and there's been no compensation for the incident, although there was an attempt by U.S. congressional representatives to send money to the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa, the capital city of Honduras. And then that money was taken and was put into a non-government organization, a Honduran non-government organization, that distributed the money in the area, in communities around where the incident occurred, but making it clear that the money was had nothing to do with the incident. Although, even though it wasn't sent specifically for the victims and family members of people that were affected by the May 2012 massacre, a lot of those people were contacted, and the money was sort of used to build or start building houses, but they were houses that were poorly built. They said that they had spent all this money on medical bills for people that were impacted by the incident. But when we went to and stayed in contact with the victims and the family members that this non-government organization had said that they were working with, we soon realized that they actually weren't receiving the money that was being reported to the U.S. congressional representatives, and that it was funds that were misspent and that never actually went to what they said that it was going to. And so it's sort of a confusing story, but basically there was an attempt to get them some money, but it was managed poorly, and it didn't actually go to the most important needs that the victims have and continue to have today.
You're hearing the voice of Karen Spring. She's a Honduras-based coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network. Also on the line with us is Judy Ansel, president of the board of the Cross Borders Network for Justice and Solidarity from Kansas City. And my co-host today is Marie Robinson, who's part of the Honduras Solidarity Network up in Northern California. Thank you, Marie, for helping out.
Happy to be here. One question. I remember, Karen, that you actually had gone to OAS, which is, again, like a two-day trip by all these different modes of transportation to get that far into the jungle. But you actually did a calculation, as I recall, of the, I think it was like $160,000 that was supposed to have gone to these people. Something like 16 or 18,000 could be documented, and the rest was sort of disappeared in typical Honduras fashion into someone else's bank account. As I recall, also, Wasn't it the person in charge of the construction happened to be a relative of the local National Party representative who was a buddy of the president? It was sort of like graft upon graft upon graft instead of reparations. So is that correct? Is that what happened?
Right, it's correct. We managed to discover through doing congressional work in the U.S. that approximately $150,000 was sent to the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa made the decision of who and what organization would manage that money. And the money actually went to the Mosquitia to talk to the victims about how much money had actually gone to these projects that this organization had insisted that they had spent the money on. I think it was less than $15,000 had actually reached the victims for medical bills and for housing needs. And then the person that was managing the money, that was managing the organization that was working with the U.S. Embassy, he was a former National Party activist. And the National Party is the party that's been in power in Honduras since the 2009 military coup.
Let's go back to Judy Ansel. You had a report on the lethal arms in the U.S. drug war in Honduras. What's happening there? There's a militarization of the country, and it's under the guise of drug enforcement. But what's really going on the ground there?
Of course, a lot of this is speculative. But if you look at the pattern, first off, Honduras is the pivot point of U.S. power in the Caribbean and Central America. It's been really strategically very important to the U.S. really since the first part of the 20th century. Honduras is the original banana republic. And if people recall, in the 1980s, Honduras was the staging area for the Contra War in Nicaragua, as well as for our aid to the right wing in El Salvador against the insurgent forces there of the FMLN. And so Honduras has been really, really important. And when in 2009, or before 2009, Honduras elected an increasingly progressive president, Mel Zelaya, who was sidling up to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, was raising wages, was funding education at long last, was controlling prices, and was threatening to redistribute land. He was overthrown with a wink and a nod from the United States. In fact, many people argue that it was more than that. He was kidnapped in the middle of the night by the military and taken to our Air Force base in Honduras, where he was then flown out of the country in his pajamas. This is a pretty well-known story. The U.S. State Department, at that point headed by Hillary Clinton, basically maneuvered around for several months, refusing to demand what all the other Latin American countries were demanding, which is the reinstallation of Zelaya, because it was an illegal coup. And there was no legal justification to remove him, despite what the leaders of the coup and the corporate leaders of Honduras were saying. But instead, Clinton maneuvered and used Oscar Arias of Costa Rica's help in order to legitimize the idea of just calling new elections, elections which the opposition, the resistance which had formed after the removal of Zelaya, opposed and boycotted. And so since then, as the new president, Porfirio Lobo, said in 2009, Honduras is open for business. And it's become a kind of a laboratory protected by U.S. military interests for the latest in neoliberal innovations. Our military presence there is thus extremely important to our strategic position in Central America, and really as far away as Colombia and Venezuela. And so the drug war became a very, very convenient excuse for increasing our military aid, just as it did in Mexico with the Merida Plan, or Plan Mexico, and just as it had done in Colombia with Plan Colombia, which both of which are an excuse to bring massive military aid and police aid into these countries, which often end up siding against the people and arming corrupt police and military, who then put down any kind of resistance of the people to the takeover of their countries by multinational corporations.
This is the Project Censored Show. We're going to take a quick break.
por ser mujeres. Nos matan queriendo atarnos, nos matan porque no pueden doblarnos ni amarrarnos. Nos matan por ser mujeres, nos matan queriendo atarnos, nos matan porque no pueden callarnos. Yo la vi, iba cantando una canción cuando un hombre la mató porque decía que la amaba. Yo la vi, tenía cielo y perdón cuando su padre la mató porque esperaba ilusionada. Nos matan por ser mujeres, nos matan queriendo atarnos, nos matan porque no pueden doblarnos ni amarrarnos.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Maria Robinson is my co-host today. On the line with us is Judy Hansel. She's the president of the board of directors of the Cross Borders Network for Justice and Solidarity in Kansas City with Honduras. And Karen Spring is the coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network and lives in Honduras since 2009. Judy, you were just saying that the drug war in Central America is really a way of militarizing governments to suppress the people. Karen, could you talk about what it's like in Honduras just for ordinary people?
I think just sort of continuing what Judy was talking about, following the 2009 military coup and overthrow of President Manuel Zelaya, the drug war was used as a justification to militarize Honduran society and militarizing communities and really strategic areas of Honduras where there is significant interest in natural resource extraction. And La Mosquitia, where this specific drug war massacre occurred, is an area that has been totally militarized by both Honduran and U.S. soldiers. And so on a daily basis, I live in the capital city, Tegucigalpa, but I frequently travel to many areas of the country, and you quickly get the impression that the country is very militarized. You see different units, military on the street with very heavy weapons, and it's not just military that are on the street, because after 2009, they said that there was just so much violence in the country that they needed to send the military to the street. So the military are permanently on the streets of Honduras, in all cities and in small towns everywhere. And they're joined by really specialized elite military police forces as well. And so there's been a whole series of new security forces that have been created, funded, and trained since the 2009 military coup. Some examples include the Tigres, which would be like a SWAT team. They're also on the streets of Honduras, and there's also the military police. And so as a citizen or as someone visiting the country, you get a really, really strong sense of militarization in the country, and the number of weapons that you see on the streets by state security forces is alarming. And then on top of that, you see like a huge amount of private security forces as well. And it's actually been mentioned by, you know, organizations like the United Nations that there are more private security companies than there are military, you know, security state forces. And so the country's very militarized. And you can go to small towns where, you know, people will say, this is a relatively safe area. We haven't had problems with crime here. And all of a sudden, you know, there will be groups of military with police walking around the communities. That's something that we saw when we went to La Mosquitia in eastern Honduras after this incident occurred. We were alarmed by everywhere that we were, we would see military and police waiting, whether it was at bus stations, whether it was at, you know, where people were getting off boats, transit areas, and it's quite alarming. And for me as a Canadian and for Americans as well, it's very alarming to see that number of guns and security forces. And
Maria, I have a question for you. If there's so much security, and for example, someone like Berta Cáceres supposedly had protective measures and was supposed to be protected by the police, and these activists on the North Coast who are supposed to be protected by the police are also getting assassinated, how can those two things exist at the same time?
This is the contradiction of the entire militarization narrative, is that because of this big insecurity, because of the amounts of drug trafficking and organized crime, and because of the high homicide rate in Honduras, we thus need to militarize. And human rights organizations in Honduras and also American and international human rights organizations say that the homicide rate is still one of the highest in the world, even though, you know, this militarization hit the streets of Honduras in 2009, so 7 years later, there's still an extremely high homicide rate and also extremely high number of activists, political opponents, really prominent activists like Bertha Cáceres are being killed. And they're not being protected by the state despite the fact that there's such a huge military and security budget. But for some reason, someone like Bertha Cáceres that is so well known internationally can be killed. And so this is the contradiction of the entire militarization narrative, is how is it possible that all this money is being poured into security forces, but it's actually not translating into citizen security. And that would be probably because the drug war and organized crime are being used as a justification for militarization, which is being used to go after political opponents or people that are resisting the really strong push behind neoliberalism in Honduras.
Here's an example, if I can break in. This is Judy. After we heard, when we were in Honduras in January, and we heard that in late December, two young men had been killed by the Honduran Navy on a beach in a remote place called Iriona, which is in eastern Honduras on the coast, we decided to go to the naval base in Trujillo, which had been in command of that operation. And with great luck, we got in and we got to interview the captain who was in charge of that naval base. And we asked him about a bunch of things, including how many U.S. advisors are down there training them and U.S. helicopters and all of that kind of stuff, all of which exist, plus Colombians who are training. But we asked him about the success of the interdiction programs to stop narco trafficking. You know, and he was very realistic with us. And he basically said, yes, we've succeeded in reducing the number of drug connections that are made in the area that they cover. He said, but they've just moved. He said that now they're moving more towards the Pacific coast rather than the Caribbean. Some of them are just going directly to the United States. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. The U.S. dumps in a whole bunch of money in order to fight the so-called drug war and militarizes a place, and the narcotics move someplace else. We're still getting plenty of narcotics in the United States. Consumption hasn't gone down, and more people die each time. It makes you wonder, what is the purpose of this war on drugs, and how do we end it?
On that note, Judy, I'd like to ask about the DEA and drugs, and of course, research shows that a good part of that money ends up in the largest bank in the world, probably $500 billion a year. The drug money is vitally important to the economy of the world and continues. So in some ways, is the DEA a regulator of the drug flow in that it controls ones that are not cooperating in that process, but allows others, particularly at the highest levels in Honduras, the oligarchs and the networks there, to continue drug selling worldwide?
Well, there's a question. Karen, do you have an answer to that?
The United States, one of the things that the United States policy has focused on in Honduras in the last couple of years is attempting to sort of extradite Hondurans and authorities or members of the Honduran oligarchy that are involved in drug trafficking. Given the fact that the justice system is absolutely a complete failure in Honduras and there's basically total impunity, and so the United States has sort of has this treaty with Honduras that allows the U.S. Treasury to put a person or a family on a list saying that they're involved in drug trafficking, and then the treaty sort of regulates the extradition of that person from Honduras to face trial in U.S. courts. And it's been very interesting watching how the U.S. has sort of used use that extradition treaty. They've used it in a couple of cases, have raised eyebrows of a lot of people because they have gone after people that are against the government, so sort of very wealthy, a wealthy family called the Rosenthal family, very wealthy family, but also very progressive, and was very against the current government and some of the policies that the current government is pushing forward. And they extradited the family, and within a couple of days, I mean, that family was worth billions of dollars. They lost a lot of their assets and a lot of their wealth.
Wasn't that one of their key assets was the major opposition newspaper, as I recall. Isn't that right?
Right. And so they had a newspaper that was very much very vocal against the government. And so they demanded the extradition of three members of that family, and it was a very prominent family. And then you saw across Honduras all these banks that this family owned just closed, the newspaper closed down. And within days, the United States basically took down one of the wealthy families of Honduras, which for poor Hondurans, this wasn't something that they were upset about because they were a very wealthy family. But in terms of the wealthy families in Honduras, they were one of the most critical of neoliberal policies in Honduras. Another example is the DEA actually went and captured and extradited the son of a former president, the president that took power after the military coup, Porfirio Lobo. And they extradited him, and he's now facing charges in the United States for drug trafficking. But if you look at how they focus specifically on that person, his name is Fabio Lobo, and he's the son of Pepe Lobo, former president, very well-known member of the National Party of Honduras, still the party in power. But it's very well-known in Honduras, and especially in communities where these cartels are operating and where the Lobo family operating is that the whole family's involved in drug trafficking. And they've just chosen this one person, the son of the family, when the uncle and the brother and the other cousins are very much linked to these drug cartels and still run drugs through Honduras. And this is a very, very well known in communities and in Honduras amongst anybody that listens to the radio or reads the newspaper. And so I think that the U.S., they cherry pick specific drug traffickers for their own interests and to deal with the problem, the people that are causing problems for whether it's the economic system or their political power.
And in the United States, I think we should be increasingly concerned about the power of the Drug Enforcement Administration. I'm looking at a letter from Representative Hank Johnson, a member of Congress who has been really strong in trying to get an investigation of the massacre in Awas that we've been talking about in 2012. And he wrote a letter just last month to the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, who has been supposedly investigating this thing now for several years. And in it, he says not only that the DEA refused to turn over records to the Department of Justice, but it also significantly rolled back the level of access to information that the Department of Justice Inspector General's office has to DEA information. And we saw this in Honduras when we talked to the head of the DEA in Honduras, who was like a cowboy. He was bragging about them shooting up this boat. And he said, when we said, what about the 14-year-old you killed? And he said, well, his mother never should have put him in that kind of danger. Never, never copping to the fact that it might have been a mistake. That poor mother has been persecuted ever since by people who are trying to bribe her and get her to lie by people who she thought were DEA agents.
That's another story. We'd love to come back to that in about 3 minutes.
Right. We're going to take a short break here. You're listening to the Project Censored Show.
Porque marcó una senda e hizo una revolución. Ahora lo quieren callar, lo quieren sacrificar. Porque a fuerza de balas le quitan su libertad. Una madrugada de gorilas y terror. Secuestran al presidente y violan la constitución. Contra el golpe militar.
de oponerse a una encuesta han dado un golpe de Estado.
Los pueblos del mundo, todos a una sola voz, gritan viva Honduras, viva su revolución. Vamos todos a luchar, vamos juntos a pelear, pa' que Venezuela ya vuelva ya. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, un pueblo que no calla. Honduras, resiste en la batalla, a que vuelva aquel que no te falla. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, un pueblo que no calla.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Marie Robinson from the Honduras Solidarity Network, lives up in Healdsburg, my co-host today. On the air with us is Judy Ansel, president of the Cross Border Network for Justice and Solidarity, based in Kansas City, for working with Honduras. And Karen Spring is a Honduras-based coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network. We've been covering issues of the DEA. Maria, you had a question you wanted to expand on.
Yes, Judy or Karen was just about to get into the story of the one victim who was further exploited when the DEA came down to investigate the matter further. So does somebody want to take up that story? I think it was Clara.
Sure, I can talk a little bit about it. Basically, when the Department of Justice Inspector General's office opened the investigation about the DEA's role and behavior during the May 2012 massacre, we think that the DEA sent officials down to Honduras, and they contacted one of the victims, one of the women that was in the boat that night that lost her 14-year-old son. Clara Woods is her name. She was contacted by a man that she didn't really know, but that she'd heard of through community members in La Mosquitia. And she was asked to come down to the capital city of Honduras because these American authorities and people wanted to help her. And so she basically, thinking that it had something to do with the investigation, she decided to travel to Tegucigalpa, and she was taken into an unmarked house, a house that was not an office. It was just sort of a house that had a guard at the front, and she was hooked up to a lie detector test, and she was asked a bunch of times by Americans. She could tell they weren't Honduran because of the accent, and she was asked multiple times about what had happened that night that the incident had occurred. And it became obvious to her very quickly as she was hooked up to this lie detector test that they were trying to get her to say that people that were traveling with her, her community members, had opened fire first on the security forces that then returned fire. Basically trying to construct the narrative that the security forces, the Honduran and the DEA, had fired in self-defense against the passengers of this boat. And so Clara would absolutely not admit that, and she wanted to leave right away, and she ripped off the wires that were attached to her and left. And then she came out publicly saying that they had tried to offer her money to change her testimony and had hooked her up to a polygraph test. And so obviously this is a really concerning issue because Clara was never given legal representation. Her lawyers were never contacted. She was offered a significant amount of money for someone that lives in poverty in Honduras to alter what had actually happened that night. And, you know, she refused to do that. And so the DEA didn't fulfill what they were attempting to do. But it was very concerning for people that are supporting Clara and supporting the victims that are seeking justice.
Wasn't she also given some pill or something to try to get her to fail the lie detector test on the second attempt or something?
Yeah, there was an attempt they gave her a pill that she was told was for her nerves. And people that know anything about lie detector tests, you're not supposed to take any medication that would alter in any way how you would react to questioning. And so because they assumed that she was going to tell the truth, as in, you know, that her son had been killed and that the security forces had opened fire on the boat without any sort of justification, they gave her a medication to try and alter the results of the polygraph test.
That's an amazing story.
Yes, that's quite a story. Overall here, what I'm hearing you say is that the DEA and the U.S. military and advisors there are in support of the current government, the power elite in Honduras, that they have a neoliberal agenda, palm oil plantations and resorts and mining operations that interfere with the people in a variety of ways and hurt them. There's a repressive military regime and a massive private military complex paid for and hired by elites in the country that's pretty repressive in terms of people's human rights, and certainly drugs are a center of this. So, Judy Ansel, how much was Hillary Clinton involved in this when she was Secretary of State? I mean, she was there when the coup happened. She was there when the massacre at Awas happened. What's been her involvement?
First off, your characterization, Peter, is right on. I think that pretty much sums it up. As for Hillary Clinton, let me just quote an interview which was actually on Democracy Now! When Juan Gonzalez caught Hillary Clinton at a campaign stop when she was campaigning in New York right before the primary there. And he asked her about whether she had any concerns about the role that she played in the situation of the Honduras coup. And she said, quote, "Well, let me again try to put this in context. The legislature, or the national legislature of Honduras, and the national judiciary actually followed the law in removing President Zelaya. Now, I didn't like the way it looked or the way they did it, but they had a very strong argument that they had followed the Constitution and the legal precedents. And as you know, they really undercut their argument by spiriting him out of the country in his pajamas, where they sent, you know, the military to, you know, take him out of his bed and get him out of the country. So this began as a very mixed and difficult situation. Well, in fact, Hillary Clinton knows a whole lot better than that. In fact, WikiLeaks released the telegram that she got from her ambassador there, Hugo Llorens, who was no great liberal, telling her that it was a military coup and that it was completely illegal. She had that information, so she's lying. You know, she switched her story about what happened in Honduras several times. And as I said before, Hillary Clinton, not alone, pressured by people like Jim DeMint, who was a senator at that time, and Lanny Davis, who was a close Clinton associate who had been hired by some of the oligarchs in Honduras to lobby the U.S. government in favor of the people who made the coup. All of these folks got together and made it impossible for Mel Zelaya, the duly elected president, to return to office. And so basically the United States enabled the installation of an extremely repressive government, which lasts till this day with, theft of election after election.
And just to mention quickly, Judy, Clinton's office was actively working to prevent Mel Zelaya from coming back into the country after the coup, months following the coup, there were thousands and thousands of Hondurans in the street demanding that he return and be allowed to return to the country. And there were many people that were killed in those protests. They were shot. They were beaten up. There was people that were disappeared and then their bodies dumped off days later. And that was very, very well documented. And the U.S. was supporting that repression against the Honduran people.
That's the voice of Karen Spring, and Honduras-based coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network, and she's lived down there since 2009. Karen, the violence after the coup that's continued, the repression has resulted in many people leaving the country or being afraid to live there and coming to the U.S., and those that have gotten here, as they've been picked up by ICE and other groups here in this country, are being deported back. In fact, Obama has deported more people than any other president. What's happened to those people when they end up back in Honduras?
They're sent back to an environment of violence and insecurity that is fueled by U.S. aid and U.S. support for the Honduran regime. And actually, I received a phone call from a Honduran environmentalist that's fighting a mining company and geothermal project in her community, and her 17-year-old son was under threat because of his mom's role in fighting the geothermal and mining project that's being pushed forward in their community, and he fled to the United States, and he was picked up. He's in a detention center, and he's scared to come back to the country. So this is sort of, it's sort of this spiraling situation where, you know, people keep fleeing to the United States, and then they're sent back to Honduras, but the violence is getting worse. And recently, actually, as a result of this so-called migration crisis, the U.S. government, or sorry, the White House approved the Alliance for Prosperity money, which was an additional $750 million from the U.S. government to Honduras to basically promote the same policies that are causing the migration crisis, that have caused the migration crisis in the first place. And so it's just the spiral. They use that justification of the migration crisis and the youth migration crisis specifically to justify the $750 million that they just sent to the Honduran government that's now being put into the exact same things that are causing the migration in the first place. Projects like dam projects, like mining projects, neoliberal tourist development, and these are all things that Berta Cáceres, the well-known environmental leader and indigenous leader, was denouncing and that was recently murdered. She was very vocal about these things. And as more and more environmentalists and indigenous leaders and opponents of these policies keep speaking out, they keep being killed as a result.
And my understanding is some 80 people that have been deported back to Honduras are now dead, killed by private mercenaries or the government. That's very troubling. So let's take a short break and just pause on that. And we'll be back in a minute.
En la casa de la justicia de mi país y comprobé que es un templo de encantadores, de serpientes. Dentro se está como en espera de algo que no existe, temible. El brillo de un arma blanca, que han adquirido el brillo de un arma blanca.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Maria Robinson is my co-host today. Thank you very much, Marie, for being with us. Judy Ansel is president of the board of the Cross-Border Network for Justice and Solidarity in Kansas City and many-time visitor to Honduras. And Karen Spring is also on the line with us, who's Honduras Solidarity Network coordinator in Honduras itself. And Karen, you were just talking about a case that you would like to tell us about of a radio announcer.
Judy, go ahead.
I just recently became familiar with the case of a young man in his early 20s who fled Honduras last summer after he was attacked for his broadcasting on a community radio station in a place called Zacate Grande, which is on the Pacific coast of Honduras, where there have been land struggles going on now for decades against the palm oil barons who are trying to steal land from poor campesinos who are defending their families. And this young man grew up in the context of that land struggle. And in fact, all he's ever known his entire life is the family trying to defend their land, getting moved, the village moving, coming back, trying to reclaim the land. And so he became an activist in community radio. Community radio is really interesting in Honduras. We have run into community radio producers in several parts of Honduras who use it as a means of fortifying the resistance, of educating people, in the case of the indigenous and Afro-indigenous people, strengthening their language and their culture. It's really interesting. And if people want to make donations of equipment from community radio stations, Honduras would be a good place to do it.
Maria, I want to interrupt you, Judy, for one sec to say that that has been true over like the last 50 years. Honduras radio has been so strong because there's still a high level of illiteracy, and with all the mountainous area and so forth, communication can be difficult, that radio has always been a very, very, very strong part of the fabric there.
Yeah. So this young man was almost killed. He barely escaped with his life. And he and his sister, who was also threatened, left with young children and went to Nicaragua. And then they tried to make it to the United States. They got deported in Mexico. They spent some time in Nicaragua, and then they went back and finally turned themselves in at the U.S. border. He was incarcerated. I'm not sure about her. And he filed for political asylum. But the problem is that they don't have any money. And you can't win political asylum in the United States without a lawyer. And lawyers are very expensive. And they're assigned to the courts in Texas, where there aren't a great number of progressive lawyers, particularly pro bono ones. And so the issue is, how do we defend these people? And they're just two of a whole number of people who have fled Honduras because of the violence. And so it's no wonder that so many of them get deported, given the attitude of the administration, because they have no legal support. We've heard about the children, the three-year-olds who appear in court with no lawyer, and how absurd that is. But it's almost as absurd for an adult to appear with no lawyer as well, who doesn't speak the language, doesn't know our very complicated immigration law, and has a zero chance of winning asylum without having the resources to defend themselves. And so that's the current situation in the United States, and it's very troubling, because really these folks who are valiant and courageous and resisting this onslaught of both U.S. and corrupt Honduran militarization, and they have no place to turn. And the United States, which used to be a refuge for people like that, has turned its back on them.
I was thinking about the latest case that, where we met someone who was fleeing, a young soldier who had left the military with some horror stories. Karen, can you update us on that situation?
There was a very young soldier that decided to basically stop, that he no longer wanted to be part of the repressive forces inside the military police that were operating inside a very, very conflictive area of Honduras called the Bajo Aguan region, where there's a significant African palm interest and plantations that are basically owned or claimed to be owned by three large landowners. He was also from a very poor campesino family, and he had joined the military, and he basically decided that he no longer wanted to be a part of it, and he had to flee the country as well. And so he's in hiding, and also he's outside of Honduras. But his testimony and sort of some of the information that we've gathered from what he told us is how he could detail very extensively the role of state security forces and death squads, and how his force was given sort of a list of people that they were told that they needed to kill as part of their operations, and sort of he no longer wanted to be part of it, and so he fled the country. I don't have much more information than that.
That's a very, very scary story, though, to me. That's a classic. If you're relying on the military to preserve order, and here they have the hit list, really terrible.
The death of Bertha Cáceres was certainly shocking to many people in this country because she was so well known. And she had won the Goldman Prize and had been here in the Bay Area, met a number of people here. But it seems to be reflective of the situation in Honduras that there really is no social justice, and that murder and disappearances and that are rampant. That speaks to that. So what's going on here, Judy, let's go to you first, in the United States to try to address this in a broader way?
We have been trying to put pressure on our government to stop the aid
to force our own forces as well as the Hondurans to be accountable for these things. As far as the death of Bertha Cáceres is concerned, we want, of course, the United States to insist that the Honduran government have a truly independent investigation, which they're not willing to do. Yes, people have been arrested, but there's a great deal of suspicion that the people in charge who are manipulating those who were arrested have not been arrested. And without a truly independent investigation, such as they had in Guatemala, which actually brought down the government, without that kind of investigation, there is not going to be justice served in her case. But the U.S. and the Obama administration has been really, really quite dedicated to protecting the government of Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras and the whole system there. They have, in their opinion, I suppose, way too much invested to risk giving any kind of encouragement to the resistance in Honduras and the forces that want to see some kind of justice. That leaves us in a really difficult position. The Honduras Solidarity Network, which comprises groups made up of U.S. activists as well as some Honduran immigrants who are in the United States, and that organization has been trying to educate people and conduct events. Currently, Bertha Cáceres' replacement, Tomás Gómez Membreño, is touring in the Midwest and has delivered a letter to Senator Dick Durbin in Chicago, to his office, demanding that the U.S. cease its military and police aid to Honduras. And his tour is being sponsored by the Honduras Solidarity Network. We've been pressuring Senator Patrick Leahy, who has been one of the stellar people in demanding that human rights be respected in places where there's U.S. aid. But he hasn't gotten very far. I talked about Hank Johnson, Representative Hank Johnson, and he wrote a letter to the Inspector General. At this point, we're waiting for, as far as the OWASP case is concerned, we're waiting for the Inspector General's report. So if people want to do something, they should contact Michael Horowitz, who is the Inspector General in the Department of Justice. I do not have an email address for him, but I'm sure you can find out how to contact him if you go to the Department of Justice's webpage. That's Michael Horowitz, Inspector General, and ask, where's the report? We've been waiting now for 4 years. Where is the report on the OWASP massacre? That's one thing people can do. But I think in general, talk to your own representatives in Congress, your senators and your congresspeople, educate them about what's going on in Honduras, and tell them to be pressuring for an end to impunity and stop the drug war. It's completely counterproductive and against the values that the United States is supposed to stand for.
Well said. Well said. Thank you. And Karen, you're the Honduras-based coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network, and our host today, Maria Robinson, is part of that group. Tell us about the Honduras Solidarity Network.
The Honduras Solidarity Network is a group of over 30 organizations from Canada and the United States. Some of those organizations have worked for years, if not decades, in support of different organizations and groups in Honduras that form the social movement. And so the Honduras Solidarity Network formed after the 2009 military coup to provide support to the Honduran social movement that came together to denounce the coup and the role of the United States in the 2009 military coup. One of the things that we're doing specifically on the OWASP case is not only pressuring in the United States with congressional representatives and Senate representatives, but also we are fundraising for the ongoing needs of the victims. One of the things that victims need from this specific massacre is they have a lot of medical bills. You know, one of the survivors had an operation on his arm, and he was going to lose the mobility in his arm, which is something very significant for a very young Honduran man. If, you know, he doesn't want to migrate to the United States, he needs his arm to be able to work in the fields, to plant beans and corn. And so we were able to fundraise to get him money to get this operation on his arm, but now he needs physiotherapy. And so we, as the Honduras Solidarity Network, we are fundraising for funds for victims, as well as this man that needs physiotherapy on his arm, to provide them with just basic immediate needs as they continue their search for justice. And so donations can be made to that fund through the cross-border networks. So Cross Border Network, which is also a part of the Honduras Solidarity Network.
So I encourage people to also visit the Honduras Solidarity Network's website, hondurassolidarity.org. We also have a fantastic Facebook page that is updated daily about things that are going on in Honduras and the U.S. role in Honduras. And we have a Twitter account, which is called Honduras Sol. And so I encourage people to get in touch with us through social media and through our webpage.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, Karen and Judy. And Marie, thanks for being co-host today. It's an amazing situation, what's going on in Latin America, and particularly Honduras. And I'm very glad that we had this show today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
I just wanted to mention also that the Marin Task Force on the Americas and several other groups do lead delegations to Honduras, and it is a safe way to travel, see the country, learn what's happening. Karen is the person who basically leads us through the country. It's definitely worth the time, and if you really want to get to know the country in some detail and honestly what's going on without risk of life or limb, it's a great way. It's a great choice. And you can see several websites, HSN, Marin Task Force of the Americas, and others.
Well, Maria Robinson, thank you very much for co-hosting today.
We want land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We will see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, if you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip our brothers in our